The two boys stand in the darkness, watching the house. The family inside have no idea, as they go about their evening routine, that anyone is lurking in the shadows. Each family member's mind is on something different: work, school, the daily problems of life. All that is about to change, though, as the young predators start to move in. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 154, The Talyot Family Tragedy. If this month presents a perfect opportunity to grab a quick long weekend at the coast or bush with family, make sure your home, cars, and bike are still under your watchful eye with Ring's range of smart security devices. Choose from Ring's video doorbells, cameras, and alarm systems paired with the Ring app on your phone to level up your home security. Visit ring.com for more info or get Ring products from Takealot, Incredible Connection, or any other Ring stockist. Make sure your possessions are secure no matter where you are, because with Ring, you're always home. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Melinda Forrest, Laurie King, and Sarah Hutto for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. This episode first appeared in the Patreon feed in 2022. Although all the murders and other tragedies I discuss on this podcast are disturbing, this one perfectly displays both the viciousness of some human beings and the ripple effect that violent crime has on people many years after the event. For the most part, although I, of course, think of the pain of every victim I talk about, these cases don't always stay with me after I've researched them, but some do. One such case was the so-called Flower Gang murders in Nivotville. That one took up space in my head for a long time after I clicked publish, and this one has too. I will warn you up front that this episode does include mention of violence toward children, so please take that into consideration before listening. My research for this case came from Chris Carsten's book, Bad Kids, as well as some of the media articles I could find about the case. So, let's get into episode 154, The Talyot Family Tragedy.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Chris and Sally Talyot met, married, and had their first child, Angeline, when they were pretty young. Chris was just 21 and Sally 19, but they were deeply in love and excited to start a family together. After Angeline was born in 1976, more bundles of joy would follow in quick succession. Another daughter, Charlene, was born 3 years later, and 5 years after that, Chris was overjoyed when they had a little boy, who they named Christoph. The family moved into a small holding in Vereeniging. The house was perfect for their brood, and they loved that the children could experience the outdoors and play safely for hours on the surrounding land. The Talyots understood, too, though, that being in an isolated home put them at risk. In some ways, it was safer, as it would be less likely a target, but in other ways, their small holding made them sitting ducks if they were to be in need of assistance. Chris did his best to ensure the family was safeguarded. He owned a licensed 9mm handgun, which he often practiced with, and ensured he kept close by at all times. Most of the windows in the home had burglar bars on them too, and as soon as night fell, the doors were locked and the Talyot family remained safely inside their home. By 1992, the oldest daughter, 16-year-old Angeline, had proven herself to be an extremely talented singer. The girl's parents felt sure that she would become a professional performer one day, and one big step forward toward that happening had just come to fruition. Angeline had been selected to perform in a concert being held at Vereeniging Civic Centre in November of that year. The Talyot home was abuzz with excitement. On the 28th of November, Angeline would take the stage and establish herself as the amazing performer she was. And then, 3 weeks later, little Christoph would be turning 9 years old. And of course, there was Christmas to look forward to after that. 5 seats had already been booked for Angeline's concert by her family, 4 for her parents and siblings, and the 5th for her great-grandmother, Joey, who decided to travel to Vereeniging for the special occasion and then stay for her great-grandson's birthday and Christmas. Christoph, of course, although excited for his sister, was far more excited about his own birthday, as any 8-year-old boy would have been. His mom, Sally, was the queen of birthday parties and always made her children's birthdays very special. Every year since Christoph had been born, his birthday party had included his favourite treat, an ice cream cake. And this year would be no different. Supermom Sally had already placed her order, and the cake would be ready for the boy to enjoy when he turned 9. First, though, the Talyots had to get their talented firstborn through her exciting event. On Friday, the 27th of November, 1992, great-granny Joey arrived in the morning, and when the children got home from school, they were suitably bear-hugged and cheek-pinched. Angeline approached her mother and asked if it would be okay if she visited a friend for a while that afternoon. The friend would also be performing in the concert, and they wanted to practice together. Sally agreed, and Angeline gave her mother and great-grandmother a kiss each and headed out the door. When it came time for Angeline to return home that night, she instead called and asked permission to sleep over at her friend's house. She would help set up for the concert the next day, and then she would see her parents at the performance. Although Sally and Chris were in two minds, they eventually agreed and told their oldest child to get some rest and they'd see her the next day. Then the Talyot family ate dinner, watched some television, and settled in for the night. With their great-grandmother staying over, 13-year-old Charlene had given up her bedroom to the woman And that night, she placed a mattress on the floor of her parents' bedroom and drifted off to sleep there. Chris and Sally were on their bed beside her. Great Granny Joey was soon softly snoring in Charlene's room, and 8-year-old Christoph was happily dreaming of ice cream birthday cake in his bed. But not everybody on the tall yacht's small holding was asleep that night. Earlier that evening, just as the sun had started to set, two slight figures had crept onto the land. 15-year-olds Samson Twala and Pietrus Mofokeng lived in a nearby informal settlement. The boys had given up school long ago and spent their days wandering the Vereeniging area, committing crimes and getting up to general mischief. Along with their school days, the boys' innocence had long been discarded on the road of life too. The violence which had permeated both their childhoods had hardened them, or perhaps simply brought out what was already there. Either way, as the two boys stood just out of sight on the Tollyard's property that night, they knew exactly what they wanted to do. Mofokeng would later claim that the plan had been Twala's doing. Somehow, he claimed, Twala had got it in his head that the Tollyard family was well off, and there were lots of spoils to be had inside their home if they could get inside. No one will ever know why they decided to hit the house when the entire family was there. Perhaps it was just the arrogance of youth, or maybe they just didn't care either way. They were prepared for any eventuality. The cold metal of a gun pressed against skin in the waistband of Pietrus Mofokeng's pants. Of course, the firearm was illegally obtained, and although he would claim he'd never fired a weapon before that night, the brutality of what was about to unfold told a different story. Twala and Mofokeng had watched the family for hours that night. They saw the flicker of television as all five occupants of the house relaxed in the lounge. Then they watched as the lounge light went off and five figures dispersed into the house, each going to their respective bedrooms. And then those lights too clicked off, one by one. The two teenage criminals knew exactly who was in the house that night. They saw the children too, and even that didn't stop them. After the last bedroom lights flicked off, the two waited another hour to ensure the occupants were deep in sleep. The last thing they needed was one of them waking up and alerting the others to their presence. Although the Tollyard family was extremely safety conscious, there was one way into their home. It wasn't something that Chris Tollyard would ever likely have suspected could be dangerous, because the gap was so small, surely no one could squeeze through it. But when the two boys lurking outside the Tollyard home saw the slightly ajar bathroom window, they knew, with their slight frames, it was an easy way in. Chris hadn't been entirely wrong. No adult could squeeze through there. But a 15-year-old boy who was the size of a child much younger than that would have no problem. And as the two boys pushed through that opening that night and their bare feet hit the cold bathroom floor, it could not have been easier. We will never know, and even if we had an explanation, I for one will never understand why Twala and Mofokeng did what they did next. They could have easily scoured the house as the family slept, taken what they wanted, and left. But that is not what they did. Instead, They left the stealing for later, for after the killing. Chris Talyot was given no opportunity to protect his family with his own weapon that night. When he closed his eyes to go to sleep, he'd done so for the last time. Beatrice Morfokeng quietly crept up to his side of the bed, keen to immobilize the biggest threat first, and fired a single bullet into the man's temple. He died instantly. Sally Talyot may have woken up from the sound of the gunshot, but if she did, she had no time to do anything before she too received a single bullet to her head from Morfokeng's gun. 13-year-old Charlene had woken up as her parents were being killed. She tried to flee, but Twala had pinned her down and covered her mouth so she couldn't scream. A single bullet into her chest had ended her life. The two boys were not done, though. They knew that there were two other people in the house. As they exited the main bedroom, they almost ran straight into Great Granny Joey, who'd heard the gunshots and was rushing up the hallway from Charlene's bedroom. Morfokeng fired a single shot into Joey's face. She too died instantly. Down the hall, 8-year-old Christoph had also been woken by the gunshots. He knew what he was hearing because he would occasionally go with his dad to the firing range when he practiced shooting with his 9mm. The terrified child crept from his bed. If he stayed in his room, he was sure he would be a sitting duck, so he slowly edged his way down the hallway. Unfortunately, as he did, he witnessed his great-grandmother being gunned down. Powered by fear, he tried to escape to the lounge. He could get out the door there and run for help, but he was soon overrun by the two intruders. Morfokeng looked Christoph in the eye for just a second before he fired a bullet into the child's body. Then the two intruders scoured the house for loot. They stole a few pieces of electronic equipment, Chris Talyot's 9mm gun, and a few other items. They loaded it into Sally Talyot's car and drove off into the night, feeling assured that there was no one left to identify them. But one member of the Talyot family had not been instantly killed that night. As the bullet entered little Christoph's body, he felt the impact, but would later say he felt no pain. He was bleeding profusely, but he was still alive. While he heard Morfokeng and Twala moving around the house, he lay completely still, pretending to be dead. Later, Twala would claim that the boy had been moaning in pain and that they'd known he wasn't dead, but when Morfokeng had gone back to shoot him again, he realized he'd run out of bullets. This would not make much sense, and Christoph would deny that this had happened, and really, it didn't make much sense, because by then the boys had found Chris's 9mm, and they could have used that to kill the boy. When Christoph heard the pair drive off, he tried to stand, but realized he could not. At the time, he thought perhaps he was just very weak from having lost so much blood, but the truth was that the bullet that had entered his body had severed his spinal cord. Little Christoph was paralyzed. The boy listened to the sounds of the house as he lay there. The clock ticking, the fridge humming, a cricket chirping somewhere just outside. They were all the normal sounds of their home. The sounds he would hear if he woke in the night in his bed and lay awake for a little while. But the soft snores of his family were now silent. While lapsing in and out of consciousness, Christoph pulled himself along the hallway toward his father's room. He averted his eyes from the body of his great-grandmother, understanding even at 8 years old that she was beyond help. At some points in his efforts, he lost consciousness for a long time before even making it to his parents' room, which was likely for the best, considering the scene of horror that would have awaited him there. Instead, the next time the little boy opened his eyes, the sun was up and he could hear movement outside the window. At first he was terrified, but soon Christoph realized it was their gardener. Jacob Radebe had been working at the Talyot home for several years. Every Saturday morning he would arrive, collect the gardening implements from the shed and get to work. He often didn't see the Talyot family until later in the morning, so it hadn't seemed strange to him when he'd arrived that day and the house was quiet. Sally's car was gone after all, so he figured the family was out. He started tending to the flower bed near the windows when he heard a small voice. It was the Talyot's youngest child, Jacob realized. As he strained to hear what the boy was saying, he heard the child ask him for a drink of water. Jacob frowned and shook his head at the boy's cheekiness. He called back something that he would regret in a few short minutes. "You've got legs, boy. Get up and get it yourself." The words had come out with a teasing tone. He imagined the boy laying in bed and wanting to be served. But the child's reply made his blood run cold. "I can't, Jacob. I've been shot." If the thought crossed Jacob's mind for even a second that the child might be making a terrible joke, he didn't let that stop him from making entry into the house. If he was wrong, Mr. Talyot would understand. As soon as he entered the lounge, he saw the streak of blood that Christoph had left behind when he dragged himself out of the room hours before. Then, within seconds, he saw the body of Great Granny Joey, and simultaneously, little Christoph lying nearby. He scooped the boy up in his arms and ran to his bedroom, placing him gently on his bed. He told him he was going to get help. And then, before he could see a single additional piece of horror that the house may hold, he rushed out and ran to the closest neighbours. Angeline Talyot was getting ready at her friend's house when their home phone rang on the morning of the 28th of November. She and her friend were about to head out to the Civic Centre when they walked through the lounge and saw her friend's dad on the phone. The man's face said it all. As he listened to the police officer on the other end of the line, his face lost all colour. He slumped into a chair as the girls watched. Angeline didn't for a minute think that the call had anything to do with her. She thought perhaps one of her friend's grandparents had passed away or something like that. When the man put the phone down, though, and looked up, it was not his daughter he made eye contact with. It was Angeline. For a long time, the information that her friend's father was sharing with her did not make any sense. How was it possible that her entire family, save her little brother who was fighting for his life in hospital, were dead? She'd spoken to her mother just hours before. She'd seen them all not long before that. Angeline Talyot, though, was not your ordinary 16-year-old girl. She was her mother's child, and had inherited Sally's gift for pushing through and making the best of every situation. She also reflected her mother's maternal instinct. She would later say that her mother was the best example of a mother anyone could ever ask for, and at that moment, as she sat in her friend's lounge, with tears streaming down her cheeks, that instinct kicked in. Her little brother needed her now more than ever. She could do nothing for her father, mother, sister, and great-grandmother
but her tears would certainly not help her brother. And so Angeline composed herself and asked to be taken to her brother. Back at the Tullyard home, even seasoned police officers had been shocked at the scene that awaited them when they arrived in the family's home. Jacob had told them where to find little Christoph, and he was given life-saving treatment on scene and then transported to what was then HF Voet Hospital. Before the ambulance pulled away, detectives, knowing this might be their only chance to speak to the surviving child, plied him with questions. It was cold and difficult to do, but they had no choice. He had vital information, and he might not even survive the ambulance drive. When the officers questioned Christoph about who had done this to him and his family, one of his answers would provide some fascinating psychological views about what trauma does to survivors' memories of events. Often when victims of crimes involving guns are asked what the offender's gun looked like, they'll describe it at least 2 to 3 times bigger than it actually was. Seasoned detectives often know this and will take this into account. The brain often magnifies the danger in memory, not because the trauma of the event was not valid to begin with, but because a greater danger will result in a greater response to the danger and hopefully save your life. Christoph's faulty description was not about the type of gun, it was too dark for him to see that, but rather about the number of perpetrators he'd seen. This mistake was likely also impacted by his age, but it's another faulty memory attribute we often see in survivors, especially in home invasion scenarios. We now know that there were only 2 intruders in the Tullyard home that night, but as Christoph was being loaded into the ambulance, he told police that there were 5. In the boy's mind, the danger presented by those 2 intruders was magnified. With this information in hand, a massive manhunt was launched. At first, police had been concerned that Angeline had been abducted, but they soon learned from Christoph that she was at a friend's house. Hundreds of policemen were called in from surrounding jurisdictions, and the hunt was on for any clue that may lead to what police thought at that point were a gang of men. Soon, Sally's vehicle was discovered burnt out in a field. The perpetrators clearly realized they'd needed to destroy evidence. Many of the items stolen from the house were also found in the surrounding area. Twala and Mofokeng hadn't wanted to be caught with any of the items, as they'd perhaps realized too late it would link them back to the horrific murders they'd just committed. Why they hadn't thought about that before pulling the trigger 5 times is unknown. As news began to spread about the horrific slaying at the Tullyard home, the organisers of the concert were certain that Angeline would not be participating anymore and started making plans to have her understudy appear. But the girl had other ideas. She told everyone who objected that her parents had been proud of her upcoming appearance. They'd been so looking forward to seeing her sing, and she wanted to continue on in their memory. If there was one thing they taught her, it was that hard work and perseverance paid off, and she was not going to let the people who'd stolen away her family's lives also rob her of the joy of performing. And so, despite no one expecting her to, Angeline Tullyard did take the stage that night. Almost everyone in the audience knew what had just happened to her family, so when she dedicated her performance to them and then went on to deliver like a consummate professional, there was not a dry eye in the house. As she sang, she was sure to train her eyes at the back of the hall so that they didn't fall on the second row of seats, where 5 chairs next to one another, were empty. Police soon started to receive tips from the community. Often in cases like this, even though a community may be wary of the police, they will feed information back when it becomes clear that protecting an offender is going to cause their community more harm than good. In this case, children had been killed and severely wounded, and very soon the name of the boy, who was really still just a child himself, was offered up: Pietrus Mofokeng. In the early hours of Sunday morning, less than 48 hours after the 15-year-old boy had shot and killed five people, Pietrus Mofokeng was arrested at a small holding not far from the toll yards. The boy's arrest would reveal the error in Christoph's statement. Mofokeng insisted that there had only been two of them there that night, and he gave police the name of the other boy, Samson Twala. Mofokeng's version of events would swing wildly as he went through different confessions. At first, he denied involvement. Then he admitted he had been there, but claimed Samson had done the shooting. Then he claimed that the entire plan had been masterminded by some imaginary man called Rasta. And finally, he admitted what the evidence would show was the truth: that he alone had fired the shots into the victims that night. He offered no explanation as to why he'd done this. Samson Twala was on the run, and although police would never give up on the search for him, they were happy to prosecute the trigger man at that point. Angeline was grateful to hear that someone had been arrested for her family's murders, but she would leave that to the police and prosecutors. She had her brother to focus on. It had been confirmed that Christoph Taljard was indeed paralyzed from the waist down. The boy, who was only informed that all of his family members were dead 3 days after he was admitted to the hospital, as doctors were concerned about his condition, would have to get used to using a wheelchair to get around. With the resilience of youth, he was soon whizzing around the children's ward at the hospital, and in time, reminding his sister about his birthday. Angeline had not forgotten. In fact, she'd been working in the background with her aunt, who would be caring for the children, to make this birthday extra special, just as her mother would have wanted. Christoph had been unable to attend his family's memorial services. Angeline had once again shown tremendous strength for someone so young when she'd asked to be the one to officially identify her family in the mortuary. Initially, police had resisted, requesting that an adult family member rather do it, but Angeline had been adamant, saying that she needed to see her family one last time and she did not want to have any regrets in the future about not taking the opportunity to properly say goodbye to them. She then went on to help arrange the funerals and sang at the service in honour of her family. 3 weeks after Christoph Taljard had survived a night of horror, he was given a brief reprieve in the form of a birthday party in his hospital ward. The ice cream cake that his mother had ordered before her death was served, and Angeline arranged a magician to perform a spellbinding show for her brother. For a moment, he was not a physically broken and emotionally distraught 9-year-old. As the magician performed his tricks and Christoph shoveled mouthfuls of ice cream cake into his mouth, he was just a boy, an innocent child enjoying his birthday. But when the balloons deflated and the ice cream melted away, reality returned. His life was no longer the same. No one's was. He would have to move schools and leave his friends behind because the school he attended was not set up as wheelchair friendly. And of course, there was the matter of the trial. From the outset, prosecutors had wanted to ensure that they had enough evidence against Beatrice Mofokeng to ensure that they wouldn't have to put Christoff through the trauma of testifying. The boy still suffered from terrible nightmares and would wake screaming in the middle of the night. The fact that he was paralyzed and couldn't run to his aunt for comfort only magnified his fear. His guardians were certain that forcing him to look at the man who'd shot him in the eye in court would have devastating consequences for the child's mental health. Those tasked with successfully prosecuting Mofokeng would do their best to avoid it. It would turn out that it wouldn't be necessary after all. In 1994, 2 years after the Tolyart family was viciously and senselessly gunned down in their home, Beatrice Mofokeng was found guilty of 4 counts of murder. If he had confessed in the hope that his youth would count in his favour, he'd been sorely mistaken. The judge ruled that the level of cold and calculated violence shown by the boy outweighed any mitigation around his youth. In fact, the judge said he would be concerned that someone like Mofokeng would only get worse as he aged, and he would like him to never be released back into society. With that, Mofokeng was taken down to start serving what, for a 15-year-old boy, must have seemed like a never-ending sentence, and deservedly so. There were others who'd been given life sentences too. Christoff and Angeline especially. Their aunt, who was now suddenly the guardian for 2 additional children, one of whom was disabled. Slowly, they began to fit the shattered pieces of their lives back together, wanting to put the violence and pain behind them and focus on a brighter tomorrow. But the South African Police Service were not finished with the case. They continued to search for Samson Twala, insistent that he too should face justice for what he'd done. And eventually, in 1999, the Brixton Murder and Robbery Unit arrested the man within their jurisdiction. He was charged with 4 counts of murder and several other charges relating to the robbery, and a trial date was set. Beatrice Mofokeng had agreed to testify against Twala. Perhaps he thought it might look good on his record if he was ever considered for parole. Whatever his reasoning, his testimony was key, and he retold the events of that night in graphic and horrifying detail, sending 4 nails into the coffin of the man who had once been his partner in crime. By this time, Angeline Tolyart was 23 years old, married and had started her own family in Gauteng. Her brother was 16, and although he'd held out hope that he would walk again one day, that seemed highly unlikely. He'd settled into his new school environment, though, and excelled at various sports. He was a member of the South African Junior Disabled Athletics team, and his goal was to make it to the Paralympics. When news broke about the arrest of the second perpetrator and their family's murders, Angeline and Christoff were in 2 minds. On one hand, they were grateful that both men would now face justice for their crimes, but on the other hand, it just felt like everything was being dragged back up again. Prosecutors never approached Christoff to ask him whether he'd like to testify in the trial of Samson Twala, and he would later admit to a journalist that he'd felt like he would have liked to have faced both men in court at that point. He said that when the first trial happened, he was definitely not in any shape to have testified, and he didn't think it would be emotionally beneficial to him at that time. But as a 16-year-old, he had wanted to look them both in the eye and tell them that they had failed in their mission to kill him. He told the journalist at that time that it concerned him that he couldn't remember what Mofokeng and Twala looked like. He wanted to be able to see them and burn their images into his mind, so that if he were to pass them in the street one day, he would know it was them. Christoph never did get to see the two men, though. Twala was convicted of his roles in the four murders and sentenced to 120 years in prison. Unfortunately, I don't have a breakdown of how that sentence was structured, and it's likely made up of four 30-year concurrent sentences. And if that's the case, the 120-year thing is really just a bit of smoke and mirrors. Either way, Twala did face justice and had to pay for what he did. But it would seem that this resurfacing of the matter 7 years later may have actually done more damage than good on the whole, at least for Christoph Taljaert. Christoph continued to excel at sports in the years after Twala's sentence, but a cloud hung over him. He'd never given up the hope that he would walk again, and it seemed that the more he excelled at sport in a disabled capacity, the more this seemed to highlight for him what his life may have been if Mofokeng and Twala had not broken into his house that night. Despite receiving significant support from his sister and aunt, in 2003, Christoph decided that the life he had been handed on the 28th of November 1992 was no longer worth living. Just 3 months after his 20th birthday, Christoph, who'd fought so valiantly to survive the first bullet that had been fired into his body at the age of 8, fired another into his own body and ended his life. Mofokeng and Twala had taken their fifth victim, albeit 11 years after the fact. I said in the beginning of this episode that this case has stayed with me since I first researched it, and I think it was for two reasons. Firstly, I cannot comprehend how two 15-year-old boys had it in them to go out of their way to kill four people and attempt to kill a fifth. And I cannot help but wonder if this was really the first time Mofokeng had done this. He would claim in court that he had only been following the instructions of Twala, but this doesn't seem to fit what happened. If anything, Twala seemed like the follower. The crime just seems completely motiveless, and I don't know why that surprises me. Maybe it's the added combination of the offender's young ages. I don't know. Just really bothers me. The other reason that this case stays with me is Christoph. I realize that we don't have a full picture of his life, and those who choose to end their lives do so for many reasons. We cannot necessarily say that it was entirely related to what he'd lived through, but I do tend to think, from the evidence at hand, that after Twala's trial and it was all brought back up again, Christoph's experiences must have played a major role in his decision to die. And then there's Angeline, the young woman who so valiantly set aside her own pain to step in for her brother. If it hadn't been for a single split-second decision that night to stay at her friend's house rather than go home, Angeline may have been among the victims. She so desperately wanted to be there for her brother, and then she had to face the fact that as much as she would have liked to, she could not carry his pain for him. And now, she's the only one left. We will never know what made those two boys do what they did that night in November 1992. The foolhardiness of youth doesn't seem to cut it in this situation. But their actions impacted countless lives long after the gun had been fired. I could talk myself in circles here, but it won't change a thing. 5 people are dead. 2 are in jail. Hopefully, for a very long time. And 1, Angeline, has to live with it all. Chris Talyot, Sally Talyot, Charlene Talyot, Joey Stevens, and Christoph Talyot. Rest gently.
If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.